Hello and welcome to edition 350 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On the show today, we'll be talking about music and the places where its many varied sounds meet. Ben Ratliff, author of Every Song Ever, will be with us later.
We'll also be getting a masterclass in how to arrange a perfect display of blooms. Floral designer Ming Vivas Carter will be showing us how and talking us through her latest project that's set to appear at London's Chelsea Flower Show this summer.
And we'll be meeting author and journalist Nick McDonald to reflect on nomadic cultures across the world and why today they're more relevant than ever.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be migrating from upstairs down to Studio One to deliver next week's news, and we'll have some new music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Welcome to the top of the show, the bit where Andrew and I reflect on the week that we've had. We've been sort of guiding our canoe through quite shallow, thick, treacly, slow waters this week, Andrew, but not been a huge amount to report. What's happened? Has anything floated your boat? Has anything...
Well, there's a new...
Has any leaves fallen into your canoe?
There's a new issue of Monocle out.
Yeah.
Kaboom.
No, I didn't see that one.
It's a big one. It's a mighty one.
That would capsize any boat that it fell into, I think, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's good. We're all getting ready for the Vienna conference. Last tickets available. Please book now. We've written a whole guidebook to Vienna.
You sounded like you were reading that off something, but you actually weren't.
Off my head.
Okay. Off someone's head.
I'm off my head. It's Sunday. Vienna guidebook coming our way soon. Paris guidebook coming our way. It's been kind of things happening in the background.
Right.
But this week was, we all have these odd months. We have 5-week runs instead of 4-week runs. And they kind of really kind of, they allow you kind of a bit of a slower start to the month, an easier start maybe to the month than usual.
And we should say, to let a little bit of daylight in upon magic upon the editorial process, that this 5-week run is greeted in the office with a sort of football style chant, isn't it? 5-week run, like that, like you're cheering for the Arsenal, right?
I'm often cheering for the Arsenal.
I don't know where to go with that. Okay, he's getting the man himself out of the news cupboard, Henry Rhys Sheridan. Henry, oh Henry, hey. Love the way you jump and rock. All right, Henry, oh Henry, love the way you take this hop. But how am I doing now? Yeah, it's good stuff there.
Yeah, it was quite good watching Henry gear up for this. You're very precise in your manoeuvring of the pop shield, chair in the right position, hands in the right place.
It's all of a piece. I mean, all these things tie into each other. It's either the mic or me has to go up and down. And because I still haven't figured out how to operate the microphone stand properly, I normally adjust my chair accordingly.
I think Henry's one of those people, if you took one of the little bits of the act out of the act, then the rest of it wouldn't work.
It would fall apart.
You'd have to go straight back to the beginning.
It's important psychological preparation too.
Yeah,
do you
exactly,
know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's kind of a ritualistic aspect to it.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Yeah, but everything went smoothly.
Yeah.
So I can launch into it if you want.
I can't wait to have a few more feathers pumped into my radio gilet that I'm wearing today.
Oh, dearie me. To begin with, on Monday, the 21st of March 2016,
that's tomorrow,
President of the United States of America, Barack Obama, will visit Cuba as part of a broader trip to Latin America. He will be only the second sitting US president in history to travel to Cuba after Calvin Coolidge in 1928.
Wow.
Now, obviously, this is, I suppose, the cherry on the cake of the normalization of US-Cuban relations that began about a year ago. And I'm excited. Cubans are excited. There was a concert there the other day with Major Lazer, and they love that. Imagine how they're going to react to Obama.
Exactly. It's a triple threat. You've got the Major Lazer, Rolling Stones, President Obama.
Yeah.
They've trodden in something, haven't they, to be so lucky.
And, most importantly, John Kerry. Who is man I'm extremely interested in.
I am.
And I'm going to segue
Is he walking without a crutch yet? Because he fell off his bicycle, didn't he?
He fell off his bike. Yeah. I think he's okay now. Okay. He's a busy man. Straight after, so they're staying there Monday and Tuesday. On Wednesday, Kerry's going over to Russia to discuss matters concerning, well, everything they're involved over there, Syria mainly, with Putin and Sergei Lavrov, his counterpart.
Do you think you can go, well, these guys used to be communists, look how nice they've turned out to be after all.
That's,
take it over to Russia, take that sentiment over the
his
seas.
Opening line is going to be.
Yeah.
But I am fascinated by Kerry because he's a man, you know, he's 72 years old. Secretary of State is almost certainly going to be the last official US government role that he has in his career. He's a kind of giant of the US political scene.
And he's a giant as well.
He is a physical giant.
Big man.
He's a metaphorical giant. But there's a sense that he's kind of like this Greek hero who's never quite lived up to his potential. He never won the presidency, famously, in 2004, lost to George Bush. He's tried on several occasions to initiate Israel-Palestine talks, most recently in 2013-14, which fell apart.
And he famously killed the Minotaur, didn't he? King Minos.
There was also that.
That was one of his...
Now, that was early in the career, and obviously it's an important part of his legacy. But, you know, what he achieved, it's just interesting that his last role is in a position which is so, or in a place in time which is so geopolitically kind of fraught.
Now's and the time so for him to come to fruition.
Exactly, there's so much opportunity for him to do stuff. Will he execute it? We'll find
Let's
out
soon.
Let's hope
so. Okay.
Moving on.
Yep.
It's quite a US-centric rundown, but there isn't interesting things going on over there.
Yep.
The next court hearing in the case of the Apple v FBI San Bernardino shooter iPhone unlocking. Was that too garbled? Do you understand what I was saying there?
People have been following the story.
I think there's a rewind button on the digital radio.
Sure. Let me throw it down. It's going to happen on Tuesday the 22nd. Now, speaking at just to give a little bit of background, obviously, you know, there's a big court case going on at the moment. You know, the government want to unlock the phone, the iPhone 5C of one of the perpetrators of the shooting.
Do you think it's fair to look on someone's phone if they've got something terrible on it?
That's a very simple way of putting...
In short, I'm saying, give us your phone. Unlock it. Let's have a look at your pictures.
There have been some rumours.
I'm not sure if that is an apt analogy for... for this particular case. I'll think it through and maybe indulge you next week.
But
right now, I'll keep my phone firmly in my pocket. But I think, you know, you've brought to light one of the reasons that this is so emotional, right? And this is engaging the population. I read a New York Times article last week, which was saying that, you know, with the Snowden FBI leaks, that was obviously a big data story, but it was so abstract to people in the general population that it was mainly a conversation that was being had between experts. This pertains to something which is in
everyone's pockets
of most Americans, and it's engaged people. It's also obviously got an emotional hook with the shootings.
And Snowden thinks that if they could do it, if they, you know, they can do it, they're just looking for the
illegal
from Apple. Yeah, I mean, they can obviously get in there and rustle around.
I mean, one thing that I found interesting, Obama last week at South by Southwest Festival said that we can't fetishize our phones above every other value, which
it's a good way of dealing with it politically, I think.
It was a measured and sane statement, as is his wont on these kind of tricky topics. But I haven't thought through it enough to be able to say this is right, this is wrong. But interesting to talk about, anyway.
And Donald Trump said, give me your phone or I'll punch you in the face.
Something to that effect, I imagine. It would certainly be in keeping with his general logic. And finally, today, on Sunday, the 20th of March, it's an important day. It's the International Day of Francophonie, I believe it's pronounced. Around 170 million French speakers across five continents celebrate the International Day of Francophonie. There's 55 states and governments which make up the organisation Internationale de Francophonie.
How do they celebrate? They speak in French.
I believe that there will be some French spoken. Cultural events and parties are held.
Cultural events. What does that mean?
But they don't stipulate what exactly French. I'll try and find a program for you later, Rob.
Concert.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe a concert.
I'll go into the town, do a concert, and celebrate the day.
But on the topic of concerts and music, one of the most interesting aspects of French linguistic conservatism to me is this quota that they have on their radios, right?
Yeah.
Which I think last December they tried to, since 1994, 40% of songs on French radio have to be French language. And they now, last December, there was a boycott by radio stations of the government because the government was trying to change the law such that they couldn't just play the same 10 songs over and over again. At least 50% of that 40% would have to be like
new stuff, old stuff,
different chansons from an earlier era. And French music
It couldn't all be MC Solar.
It couldn't. It couldn't be MC Solar.
It could be Daft Punk.
It probably not Daft Punk either.
All the good ones. You've got to have you know.
It would have to be a francophone air track. Yeah. Should be stipulated. Maybe they tried to get around the law in that regard.
Yeah, I guess.
But I don't know that it's interesting. French music I'm ambivalent about.
Could be Laurent Bachelet or someone.
Could be.
Yeah.
Serge.
Yeah.
Don't forget Serge.
That's good stuff, you see. I'm thinking yeah. go further back.
That's all I've got.
Well, that's really good.
I thought they were substantial.
I like that your light, your equivalent of Tom Edwards's cheese rolling in Somerset was
cultural.
about sort of a veto by French radio stations of the French government's francophone playlist.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's good framework.
I raised the brow, I hope. Not that it's difficult with following Tom Edwards.
Our brows are higher then.
Yeah,
are they not
brows angry? Raised. And don't forget, we want to look at your phone.
I will think about that.
It's a matter of. I'm just putting rank here. I mean, it's not a question. Really.
Ben Ratliff has written about jazz and pop music for the New York Times for the past 20 years. That's a lot of listening, a lot of writing, and a lot of thinking about how music works. Now Ben has compiled some of his thoughts into a new book called Every Song Ever.
But this just isn't a romp through the greatest hits of music's past. It's a book made up of 20 essays that take into consideration the way that music actually sounds. And as Ben has found out, when you strip away the confines of genre from artists as seemingly at odds as 19th century classical composer Franz Liszt and contemporary hip-hop stars Outkast, there's more in common than we might think. And he joins us now on the line from our New York bureau. Ben, welcome to the programme. First of all, congratulations on a fascinating book, really. And I wondered, first with the kickoff, is this book something to address the crazy glut of music that we now have in the internet age? Is this a tonic for it?
Yeah, it begins with the abundance surrounding us, which a lot of people seem to characterize as a great problem and a source of anxiety. And I suppose I can understand it that way, but I don't really feel it myself that way. I'm excited by the abundance. I mean, it's just that we find ourselves now at this moment when we have, you know, easy access to what seems like every song ever recorded. It isn't, of course, but it can seem that way. And we're such fast adapters now. You know, we just move on and this becomes the new reality and we don't look back. But I guess in this book, I'm sort of saying, look, let's mark this moment because the listener has a whole lot more power now than the listener used to have, let's say, 10 years ago.
Yeah, and it struck me from reading the book, Ben, that you come to it, you are a music critic or you're a music writer, but you come to it, actually it reminded me of how musicians talk about music, that it's having a feel for something rather than being snobby and sniffy about genres, about cool artists, uncool artists, all the rest of it. Is that kind of part of it, that music for the sort of like what you might call the golden age of the album era was kind of guarded preciously by journalists and people that had the kind of keys to genre and the keys to knowing and being able to write about it? Do you think there's any truth in that?
I'm glad you said that. I mean, yeah, I do think there's some truth to that. It's not very helpful for me in my work to think too much about genre. I think genre is really good for selling music. It confuses the issue sometimes when you think about it a lot in trying to understand it as a critic. I do run into musicians sometimes who talk about how like all music is related. You know, I have heard musicians say that. And sometimes it actually is related because of specific rhythmic reasons or whatever. But in this book, I'm trying to figure out ways to connect different kinds of music that might seem very far apart through more universal ways of listening. In other words, not breaking it down into melody, harmony, rhythm, not breaking it down into genre, but by doing much bigger ideas based on the listener side of things, like repetition or speed or slowness or whatever.
Ben, before we dive into the actual book, on this question about there being so much available to us, and you're saying it's not a problem, you do also point out, though, in the book, it's a bit like these algorithms that now kind of run, whether we're listening to Apple Music or we're listening to Spotify, that in a way they end up serving you the same thing again and again. Sometimes it's your favourite meal, sometimes it's not. I was commenting to someone the other day that it felt to me like unless you were kind of actively involved in picking really particular songs and playlists, somehow on Apple Music, I always ended up at Justin Bieber without any effort. All roads seem to lead to Mr. Bieber at the moment. And I felt the opposite, that in a way, all these algorithms, they shut you down very quickly into a narrow space. And your book seems to be trying to crack that open a little bit. Are you concerned that in this world of, you know, plenty, there is this narrowing of what we end up hearing?
Yes, I am concerned. Totally. Yeah, and I think, and I want this book to be the anti-algorithm. I mean, this is, well, what streaming services, you know, the word that they like to use is discovery. They want their subscribers to discover new music. They feel that that's a very attractive concept, which of course it is. You want to discover something every day. You want surprise every day. But I think that what's going on so far is they are figuring out basically what you like and sizing you up as a type of listener, which involves reducing you. It almost has to. And they will, in a way, yeah, feed you the same meal over and over again. It won't be the same artist over and over again. It'll be things related to that artist, or things that sound like that artist, or things that they have determined to be related to that artist in terms of your listener profile. Obviously, this is going to get more and more sophisticated, and these people are very smart. But listening to music is such a creative act, and so important to how we develop as human beings, that I don't want all the power to be given over to algorithms. I feel very funny about that.
I wanted to ask you, Ben, about plumping on the chapters for your book. You start off with slowness, fastness, repetition. You talk also about sadness, and you talk a lot about Nick Drake. Many listeners will be unsurprised to learn in that chapter. There's such sort of big, solid things to kind of get your teeth into as subject matters. Is this a book you've been itching to write for years, ever since you've been proud of a big record collection and knowing something about music?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's the product of 20 years of writing about there are people who write about classical music at the New York Times, and then there are the other people, and I'm one of the other people. So my bailiwick is everything that isn't classical music, which is really wide, you know? It's very wide, and I have been wanting to write about music in the wide view, in the large sense, not restricted to a particular tradition or a particular genre, and this seemed to me to be the way to do it. I'm coming at music through sound, you know, through experiences of sound, which is true to how I hear music normally. I think about what's the way in. If there's something I haven't heard before and I just don't know about it, I try to think about what is the way in through sound. And then second, after that, I will think about, well, you know, what's being said in the lyrics? What are the issues here? What's the political position, etc. But for me, what works is sound first.
One of the things that, you know, that, as you say, you pick on these themes, repetition, slowness, speed, silence, to bring together groups of music to get us to think about music in a different way. I wondered if you felt that there was a need to re-energize people to feel that there should be some almost like music appreciation. You shouldn't just feel that there's stuff out there that's going to get you, you know, running on the running track, or kind of, you know, that's dance music. That there is a way of understanding music that actually takes a little bit more effort, you know, a bit like reading a book or doing a crossword puzzle. You should be a bit more intrigued and a bit more kind of hardworking almost at finding your music.
Well, yes, I do notice, especially on streaming services, that music is divided into practical functions, as you say, music to help you when you're in the gym, music to accompany cocktails. And sometimes I think about music that way too, but I don't know. I mean, I think that music is mysterious, and music is medicinal, and music helps you grow emotionally. It helps you with pattern recognition. I mean, it's amazing for the brain, and it helps you learn foreign language. I mean, you know, music is so powerful beyond narrow functions. that, yeah, I guess that's the way I think about music.
Ben, I've got a bit of a personal question for you here. I on reading the book, it's very attractive for its quality of learning, of exhibiting its learning very lightly. But I wanted to ask what your ideal place to listen to the music was. Sure, you ride the subway and have music in your earphones. But how on earth do you go home and sit down and pick out a favourite LP and play it? Is it a little bit of a communion, or what is the best place to listen to music and new music?
Wow, I do so much of my listening alone, I realize, now that you're asking me this question. I share music with my family now I'm thinking about it. I share music with my family often before dinner, when I want to say to them, you know, hey, I heard this thing, let's hear it, let's experience it together. And this is just the nature of things now. Most of the listening that I do in a day is done alone. When I go running in the morning, I hear it on earbuds. When I am driving in the car, I'm usually alone. But that's the story, I think, of music in, you know, over the last 100 years, from something experienced together to something experienced largely by oneself.
Well, Ben, thank you very much for your time. That was Ben Ratliff, author of Every Song Ever, a fantastic book, and also reading just for its reading lists alone. Thank you very much. Time for some new music now. This is Sydney-based, Hong Kong-raised producer and singer Rainbow Chan with Nest.
That was very nice, Rob.
She was good, wasn't she, Rainbow Chan? We watched her video, didn't we, earlier?
On the YouTube.
On the YouTube section of the internet. I don't know whether any of our listeners are familiar with that.
Before.
But it's a website, apparently. Not an app. I don't know.
You can see all sorts of things there to do with popular culture, including Rainbow Chan with Nest.
And old editions of Hello, Hello.
I think there's even a whole section for Monocle as well.
Is there?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. I'm going to go up and watch it. I'm going to go and watch you, Andrew.
But in the meantime, you're listening to Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
We're going to be getting a little green-fingered on the weekly now. Our next guest is floral designer Ming Vivas Carter, founder of Vivas Carter, one of the most in-demand flower display companies in London.
And her work will be going on show at the biggest floral event of them all later this summer, the RHS Chelsea Flower Show. And Vivas Carter will oversee a display representing the work of London's new Covent Garden Flower Market, the historic site that keeps London in bloom all year round.
The concept for the design is called Behind Every Great Florist. But then every great florist has to start somewhere. And today, Andrew and I are starting at the very beginning with a masterclass from Ming. At the beginning with a masterclass. I like that. Right. Welcome to the programme. Thanks for making it so sweet smelling in here as well.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We need to quiz you about your company, yeah. First of all. So, yeah, I think people listening in may have, you know, impressions of somebody who does flower arranging, flower decoration, flower installations as being, you know, a one-man band, two or three people. I think you said you've got over 60 people now,
yeah.
And a vast kind of warehouse space that you work from. What kinds of things are going on there that you need so many people and so much space?
Well, I think we do over 400 events a year, and we have about 14 florists. So they do purely flowers. And then we have holiday designers, and they design the flowers before the florists get to make them. And we have carpenters and set builders and lighting and sound. So it's quite a big company.
This is for fashion shows, this is for launch events, this is for all sorts of anything.
All sorts of things, private events and, yeah, you know, big corporates trying to say thank you or to say, look, I'm here, look what I've done, or just, you know, someone's private dinner party.
And tell us, in that world of, you know,
corporate events and presentation and showing a kind of a brand image. When people come knocking on your door, you're aware of it subtly out the corner of your eye if you're just a regular punter like us going to these events. You see that the tides of change in... There's a whole kind of world of fashion that's connected to floral displays. You suddenly had a period like 10 years ago where it seemed to be all chopped off grasses and very kind of sticky and brutal. And now there seems to be a bit of richness coming back into the world of displays. Are you caught up in that? Do you notice it changes over the years, what people want, what they expect from you?
I think it's changed quite a lot, certainly from the beginning when I started 100 years ago. The arrangements were much more stylized and a little bit more controlled, I would say. And now, because so many more people are artists and floristry has become more artistic, we can make huge stuff. And also we can, you know, we've got the technology to make enormous arrangements because our company can build a structure for us to put the flowers on. And I think everyone aspires to do bigger and better stuff. And we're on the list of the Natural History Museum, the Victoria and Albert Museum, the Tate, loads of galleries. And we have to wait till the people, the punters, we say, leave before we can do the party. So normally we only have an hour and a half to set up quite a large party, maybe, you know, for 400 or 500 people. So we have to build everything beforehand, dismantle it, and then put it back together again very quickly on site.
And as you say, you're talking about, we're going to look at some of the plants here and the flowers you brought in a moment, but you're talking about often things which are very small and dainty on their own. Some of the images I saw for the work you've done, huge, extraordinary. Are there just literally hundreds and hundreds of flowers going into some of that work?
Yeah, hundreds. Hundreds and thousands of flowers. That's why we have so much mechanics underneath it, because they have to be kept fresh and alive the whole period of the time. So it's... takes a lot of working out, very technical for something that's so creative.
Do you want to get your hands a little bit? Do you want to get green fingered, Andrew?
Yeah, I do.
Do you
want
to get a peaty thumb?
I think we should tell listeners. We kind of revealed both of our, well, kind of like secret passion. My dad used to love kind of flower arranging. So yeah. we actually did know one or two of the plants. And this material, Oasis, I think both Robert and me were like remembering as a kid. It's like this kind of green material that holds the plants. There's something kind of fascinating about it. I don't know if you want to stick your finger in there.
Yeah, I was very impressed that you knew anything, actually.
So, Ming, tell us what you've brought along here. So this is, we have a kind of a wooden box here with two bricks, as it were, of this kind of oasis that holds the flowers in. And what are we going to try and create?
Well, to tell you why we brought this in as opposed to a traditional flower arrangement that you'd expect to see, is because when we at Vivas Carter interview people for the florists, we want them to be able to show us whether they love flowers. And to actually learn how to make an arrangement is quite a long process. It takes a couple of years to learn how to do it properly. So when they come and they haven't done anything before, we give them a whole load of flowers and ask them to make a sort of tapestry, a carpet, if you like, of flowers, so that we can watch how they handle the flowers to make sure that they understand the product. Because you have to be very gentle. And as you say, they're all quite small, delicate blooms individually. And when you put them all together, you need to be very careful that you don't bruise one when you're putting the other one in. Mm. So we'll just see how good you are now.
Okay, I should explain, you've brought along one that you've made earlier, as they say in television.
Yeah.
And just before I start, so one of the things that's a bit daunting before I begin is obviously you have an eye for colour and tone, which is as much about the plants you've chosen. Is that when you're looking for kind of new hires, is that something you're also looking for? Not just the way they handle the flowers, but they have some kind of sensibility about colour and tone and how those plants are going to look together?
Yeah, because it is all about textures and colours. And I think when you're choosing the flowers, it tells you a lot about the character of the person who's doing it and what kind of imagination they've got. And there's no wrong way of doing it, but it can look terrible if it's not done nicely or with thought. And it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to make it.
You're looking for sympathy between the blooms, but you don't want just a carpet of ordinary.
And if you give someone, you know, if you give someone a tumbler and give them a few stems of flowers and they try and force too many into it, everything becomes very strangled and uncomfortable. And we're trying to say that, you know, this whole idea of floristry is that you really should be celebrating the flower itself and the way it moves. And you know, you should look at a stem, like if you pick up a piece of jasmine and it naturally falls one way or the other, you should use it in the way it falls, not try and force it into a different shape.
So this is a deep psychological test. So, well, no pressure, Andrew.
No, so while, really while Robert, what Robert talks to, and before I just dive in, is there any top tips I need to know? Do you start from the centre out, or am I...
I would start from a corner.
Okay.
And then I would start with one flower and decide where you want to put those.
Just get a bit,
look,
okay.
You need to look at everything you've got.
Yeah, so, get a bit freestyle, Andrew.
Okay. Yeah, a bit freestyle. But and I've given you a very sharp pair of scissors, so please be careful.
I will do.
Don't know what your health and safety rules are.
I think we're
health and safety free here, I think it's
okay.
Fine.
Okay.
As he goes, ouch, as he cuts.
And we were talking about, Andrew was talking about asking about styles, Ming, to begin with, and sort of saying that things were a bit spiky and awkward 10 years ago, and now we've got a little bit more of a mellifluous, maybe a wild sort of cottage garden thing, at least in an English way. There has to be a time since you've been running your company when flowers have kind of gone out of fashion a bit completely and people wanted video projections or something. Do flowers themselves go in fashion?
I think definitely during the recession, the fashion changed quite fast and people didn't want to be seen to have flowers because it's immediately considered wasteful because it is a product that's only for one night. Although if you've been to a party that don't have any flowers, it's really,
you feel a bit sad.
Really dry and sad. So they make a huge difference. And we have, you know, when we have been much more careful, obviously, when recession hit. We went through a sort of very controlled domes of flowers and smaller, but quite intricate, and not any huge displays because no one wanted to look wealthy.
And then also, and in terms of colour and things, I notice you've got some quite springy, lime greeny sort of fresh blooms in there. There seems to be a fashion. I bought flowers this week at my local flower stand. There are a lot of these fresh blooms. I suppose there's something springy about them, viburnums and these sorts of things. Maybe is there a trend for things like that at the moment?
There's a trend for a colour range, I think.
Yeah.
At certain times of year and. Right now, because it's because of the spring, flowers are coming in.
People want
in.
To echo that a bit.
Yeah, and they do echo that. And also, I think that there's a lot of, if you're, lots of interiors have got a certain colour theme going through them, so you'll find that the tissue paper will be grey and the flowers will be in much more sort of muted tones. And then later on, they'll pick up again for the summer. It'll be pretty soft pinks and pale blues. And then in the winter, it's much darker again. So it, and I think interiors and fashion dresses and so on, if you look at all the catwalk stuff and especially the autumn winter stuff coming in, it's being shown now later on, you'll see that the colours are quite strong reds and quite, you know, intense. So those will all come through in the flower industry.
I must say, Ming's being very generous, not diving in, saying, what on earth are you doing?
Should we cut
I've
back?
Got, I've got a white tulip. I've got a white tulip.
So Andrew's bedded his oasis with some white roses.
I'm sure I was meant to be a little bit more sparing, but I've gone for the miniature white red.
Without a word
of
criticism.
Are my tulips out of proportion?
Yeah, your tulip's too tall. But actually, you're doing quite well.
It's quite good, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. Okay. It's actually very good.
There's a pub on the end of our street here called the Tudor Rose, and I think
he's just broken the tulip.
Like the sign for
it. Oh my goodness, he's being really rough now.
No, no, I'm being encouraged to hurry up by Mr. Robert Bauer.
No, I'm not.
Must never hurry an artist.
I'm not hurrying an artist. I'm hurrying Andrew.
And Ming, tell us, one of the reasons we have you here today is because you are about to, in the summer you'll be at the Royal Horticultural Show, the Chelsea Flower Show, and you'll be representing New Covent Garden Market. So obviously Covent Garden Market, we said it was a historical site, it moved out some time ago, but this is where people go and buy many of the flowers. Is this where you kind of rock up at 5 o'clock, well, maybe you send your team these days, but where your team rock up at 5 o'clock in the morning to buy the best bunches that are around?
Yeah, the girls go at about four every day, and they'll buy our flowers. We do order quite a lot from the market, and then we pick out the special flowers, I'd say, to add to the order, because obviously if you're ordering 30,000 roses, you need them to be there, because you won't be able to get that many. The flower market has supplied florists forever, because obviously without them, we wouldn't be anywhere. And so we're all trying to keep the market going and supporting it, because there's lots of people can order flowers online, the same as clothing and so on and so forth. But if you order everything online, you can't see, touch, feel, you know, be inspired by something new. So I feel it's really, really important to keep it there.
Yeah, and what's that like? What's the vibe like? Is that a lot of? Is it a bit like a fish market might have been, or anything, or well, Smithfield?
Smells a bit nicer.
But is it that? Yeah, is it a lot of hollering and shouting and best offers and all the rest of it? I mean,
no,
or is it? Or is
it's
it
not.
People
it's
know what they want,
more,
and it's
There's no bartering. And I suppose because we've been buying for so long, that they wouldn't overcharge us. They might overcharge, you know, someone who walks in off the street. It's all about the quality of the flowers for us. And we buy from three or four major stands and then we pick and choose from other people.
And I must say, this room smells amazing because you
tell us about it. It's looking really nice now. Look.
Let's talk through some of the buds, actually.
So I'm sorry you can't see it, but he's done a really amazing job. He's got white tulips, ranunculus, spray roses, and little touches of jasmine just poking up through everything. It smells amazing.
It smells pretty. It smells high in here.
Yeah, and he's actually not squashing any flowers. He's, we might even offer you a job.
at last, this is the secret is out. This is breaking out. This is why we got you in here.
He's working quite fast.
Next week this will be a solo show. Ming, what else have you got in your arrangement there that you've set before us, which looks very, very optimistic, very springy, very fresh?
Yeah, it's got lime green santini and a yellow santini.
I love those.
Those are really pretty. Yeah. And they're just intense little tiny petals. Mm. And then it's we've put a few paper whites, some muscari, some lovely bits of ferns, tiny tufts of jasmine, not quite as much as you've got over there, skimmia, phlox, roses, little spray roses, tiny, tiny bits of white spring blossom, white scabious we've got, buried ivy, but only little tiny heads of it. So it's really tiny, and it's more of a sort of, I would say it's more of a tapestry of flowers than an arrangement.
I'd say mine's a bit more like a worn carpet. It's got a few patches still to be filled.
It's more of a shag pile, actually. But it's green and white, so you're not going too far wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, you need to strip the leaves off the bottom of that before you put it in, otherwise you'll ruin your oasis. You won't have any room to put anything like
that. You won't have anything to stick your thumb in later.
I think we're going to have to pause in a minute. But marks out of 10, how have I done?
Let's have a look at it. I need to look at it from the top.
I think you would have about an 8 there.
It's pretty lovely.
It is very good.
If I saw that on the...
I'd have your roses slightly different heights. But it could be really fussy. But actually, as a first time, very, very good.
Well, I think as a first effort.
I think
it's a first effort. It's excellent.
It's pretty good. Let's talk about the garden, your Chelsea garden, Ming. Where on earth do you start with something like that? Is it something you've been itching to do and you have a sort of, you know, a voice in the back of your head that's saying you need these. You have sort of two or three varieties that you want to incorporate, or how does it start off?
Well, we've done quite a lot of things at Chelsea, but always for another client. Yeah. But we've never displayed anything.
Yeah.
And so when Covent Garden asked us to be the florist behind Every Great Florist, we were really thrilled because the stand is in the tent, and it's not a garden. So it's a free standing stand. It's about 3 metres by 2 metres. And their brief to us was, behind Every Great Florist is the flower market. So how do we get...
Surprise, surprise.
Ta-da! And so how do you get that across in a small space and something that's going to last for 7 days in a tent?
And he's really proud of himself.
Sorry. I'm really pleased.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
That's very good.
Yeah.
Going to call the headmaster in.
Yeah, so
I am the headmaster.
Yeah. I get a gold star. And something's going to last for a week.
For a week. And we were trying to represent the flower market on one side of the stand and the florist on the other. So if you go to flower market, which I hope you will come, all the flowers are in a bucket, which is a specific shape of bucket, and it's very iconic. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So they all the buckets lined up on the floor, and you can look at this tapestry of flowers. So we took the bucket as the hero image, I guess, and we have made a wall of these buckets, which will be full of flowers, and then the buckets, they sort of not collapse, but they go into a sort of vortex, which is meant to sort of be the florist's imagination. So the front of the wall is all white and green, these black buckets, really strong, clean image. And then the flowers get sucked into this vortex, florist's brain, and explodes on the other side in colour.
And you get Andrew Tuck on the other side.
And Andrew is going to be doing
it.
He's going to be a freelancer.
Can I just say that I've made something, I say. It's about 8 inches by 8 inches. And when you think that the amount of effort and the amount of flowers that go into something that small, and I look at the work you've done, you just realise how many hours must go into, and how much skill and how much effort goes into it. It's a really amazing, amazing work, Ming. Really great to have you on the show, and thank you so much for giving me an initial masterclass in how to become one of your trainees. Thank
you're
you.
Very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. You very much.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
The movement of people around the globe is, of course, a very timely topic. One only has to look at the tragedy unfolding across Europe for thousands of refugees who are fleeing the Middle East to see the relevance today of the causes and consequences of mass migration. But what about those cultures for which a nomadic lifestyle is ingrained in their history and also their well-being? Nick McDonnell is an author and journalist whose new book, The Civilization of Perpetual Movement, Nomads in the Modern World, looks to address some of the misunderstandings about nomadic culture.
Nick is also a novelist who had his first book, 12, published at the tender age of 18, and he's reported from Iraq and Afghanistan in the time in between. But travel has always been an essential component of his work, and he joins us now to talk about the book and to reflect on where nomads find themselves in 2016. Nick, welcome to the programme. We mentioned that, you know, that travel and that you've been in Iraq, Afghanistan and all the rest of it has been very much part of your beat. But this is not a travel book. In fact, in the introduction, you say that specifically it's not a travel book. It's more of an academic book. But what drew you to nomadism? I mean, because I know that you're concerned with not being Orientalist and romantic about them. But maybe that was the trigger. So tell us.
Well, it started in a very particular time and place. I was reporting a story for Harper's Magazine in Darfur in 2007, and I didn't know anything about the conflict, but I had the great pleasure of traveling around with a nomad expert, a guy named Ibrahim Yusuf, and it turned out that nomads were very important to that war that was going on and remain so. And so I thought, totally fascinating. And then thereafter, everywhere I was reporting, I always asked about nomads. And that was sort of how it came about. When I got to graduate school, I read a book that said nomads have nothing to do with international relations. And I thought, aha, this is something I can do my homework on.
Yeah.
And that's how the book came about.
And are they considered not to be part of international relations and general politics because of their very nomadic nature, that people can't pin them down, that people are fearful of them?
Well, I don't want to generalize too much. There are a lot of really smart academics who have dealt with parts of this. But this particular book that riled me said nomads have been no part of international politics for 500 years. And this was a textbook assigned to me. And so I thought, that doesn't make any sense. And so the book was an answer to that.
Okay. Now, part of the, I guess, people's unwise or misplaced view of nomads is that they tend to be herding goats or camels or sheep. They tend to be probably not very educated. They tend to be closed off societies, not connected to world trade, and not very useful to outside organisations who maybe want to have influence within a country. These are all the things you begin to pick apart. Give us a bit of an impression of how you see the contemporary nomad and why they're actually much more vital and interesting than people first give them credit for.
Well, I think that a great number of nomads are not well-educated, poor, and herding goats. That is part of the deal of nomadism. But at the same time, they are by virtue of the technological revolution of the last 30 years, connected to everybody else. And so you see the juxtaposition, you see the cell phones, watching Korean DVDs while you're not herding your goats in your yurt on the Gobi Desert Plains. So all of that is happening. But they are also more relevant to governments once you look at the history, because the whole history of the state is to tax people, conscript them, put them where you want them so that you can build something, to the great good for a lot of us and many people. But nomadism is a decision often not to be part of that, to keep moving so you don't get taxed, so you don't get conscripted. And in that way, they are underrepresented in a lot of governments and can do a lot of good were they integrated into those governments.
And is that why people, you know, many central governments have in the past been fearful and mistrustful of them? You know, I know here at Monaco we did an interesting couple of stories about the Sami people way up in Norway, in Finland and Sweden. And even there, these are, you know, liberal-minded democracies. And it's only recently they've given them a talking shop, in effect, you know, their own Sami parliaments. They've begun to recognize the things that were done to them, the taking away of children from parents, all sorts of really extraordinary things. And these are liberal-minded countries, as I say, who go out of their way, you think, to kind of look after people. And here on their doorstep, they had a kind of a tragedy and a black mark in their book. So when you go to some other countries, you mentioned Mongolia, you think of Russia. Is this why there has always been this bit of distrust of the nomadic movement?
For sure. Ibn Khaldun said the desert is the reservoir of the city, and he was an optimist. But most governments have thought, wait a second, these guys are moving around and we can't keep a hold of them? That's no good. The Sami in the Arctic are way ahead of most of the nomadic peoples. I had a great time up there traveling around with the reindeer herders. And at the International Center for Reindeer Husbandry, where they have reindeer on the curtains and reindeer on the fridge and reindeer on the doors, this like taken very, very seriously, as it should be.
And on the dining table.
And on the dining table. And I had reindeer sashimi while I was up there,
which
is something that they called it. I don't think I'll have that again. But they have some great food up there.
Yeah.
I got distracted. But is
this why people have tried to, in effect, stop them from moving, saying, we need you to, you know, stop living in a tent, live in a house, because then we know what you're up to?
Yes. So an excellent example would be beef production in Kenya. So, you know, world beef consumption has been rising very rapidly over the last 20 years, particularly in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And Kenya is a great exporter of beef. And if you look at the numbers for Kenya's beef export, you will see that most of the numbers come from subsidized large-scale ranches that the government makes money off of and can help their sort of pals in that industry. But a couple of wonderful anthropologists named McCabe and Harrison, I believe, went to go and look at the actual cows. And it turned out that the cow meat that was leaving was not the kind of stuff that was on the ranches. In fact, it was coming from the nomadic pastoral community. And so you have this vast export that is not attributed to this group that makes the stuff. And this is pretty wonky economics of beef. But if you think about that, that's happening wherever there are nomads anywhere in the world. And so the camel milk market, for example, is like $1 billion market that is sort of just not paid very close attention to.
But it is dependent on all these nomads for its production and its movement around the world.
Exactly. And in terms of climate change, for example, if you look at the way that China is treating the Mongolians, what they call themselves the Inner Mongolians, Southern Mongolians, they want to secede from China, some of them. The Chinese government accuses them of degrading the pasture land on the Chinese-Mongolian border, and this results in the Yangtze River flooding, for example. But the science of it is such that, in fact, they are not responsible for this, and that they've been doing this for so long, you know, sort of proves that. But the Chinese government says they are and so wants to settle them all in one place. And why they want to do that is not for the climate change reason that they suggest, for example.
It's a similar thing to the founding of the United States, I suppose, or the whitening of the United States. I wanted to ask you in one of your early answers, you talked about nomadism either being something that you opt into or what we might call the rest of the world being something that they are opting out of. What about people that want to break out of that? I wonder whether you've found that nomadism is a bit of a dying art.
Yeah, and I had a lot of camel milk with a lot of people who said, boy, you know, this is good.
You've
when
contributed to the billion-dollar market there with yeah, one fell swoop.
They were very generous. I usually got all the camel milk I could drink for free. But you know, I remember sitting with an old lady once in Mongolia, and she said, you know, this is the best way to live. You know, and this was a woman who was, you know, she watches the same kind of television I do. And she said, it's the best way to live when the weather's good. When the weather's bad, no one wants to be out there chasing sheep. And obviously, I want my children to go to Ulaanbaatar and to have a different kind of life and different kinds of opportunities. But that doesn't mean she wants to give up this thing that she's had in her life and her culture forever.
How complicated is it to study something where people are on the move, don't perhaps have written records, don't produce, you know, statistics about, you know, their gross national product, as it were? Did it make it a complicated thing for you writing an academic book about this when you're after sources all the time and they're literally kind of moving in front of your eyes?
It did, but that was the great thing about the research. That was the fun part of the research. It's the kind of research that you kind of have to be out of the library to do. The great historian James C. Scott said that it's the peasant's job to stay out of the archives. And the same is kind of true of the nomad. Because there are Bedouin novels, and there's a Sami newspaper, and there are things like that. There aren't that many.
Yeah, I mean, you've obviously been an itinerant journalist, and you've been to some interesting places at some very interesting times. Are you a bit jealous of nomads?
Oh, you know, most of the nomads I've spent...
Or is that question too simplistic?
No.
But even so, try not
to. No, I've had... sometimes. I mean, I think that it's a... The lesson for me of the book was that you don't have to live the way it looks like you have to live. Mm. You don't have to live in a big city. You don't even have to live, you know, according to the rules of the state. You know, there were other options at some point. That said, when I was bombing around the Gobi Desert in a Russian van, I was often invited to sleep in the tents with the families. And usually at the end of the night, I wanted to go back and sleep in my own tent, you know, where I would zip my flat right, zip the door up and read the Kindle. And, was grateful for that privacy.
And perhaps you could just tell us, you spent a lot of time in Mongolia. When you look from outside the country now, there does seem to be, especially in places like Mongolia, you know, still a kind of some reverence for the lifestyle. And it's certainly become part of their tourist allure, even how they package themselves around the world, that the nomads have kind of gained a kind of more central place in a country like that. Do you feel that in some nations, nomadism is beginning to gain a bit of more respect from those authorities, as we said, in years past, would have done anything to crush it?
Absolutely. But not fast enough for some of the nomads. There's this wonderful guy, Mongolian guy named Munkbayar Tsetsergi, who was a sort of a radical nomad activist and wants Mongolia not to change one bit. And he's a little too radical for my tastes and for the tastes of most Mongolians, I think. But he famously rode his horse into Sukhbatar Square and fired an arrow into the window of the parliament building to make his point, with his attorney next to him on another horse. And so people are on speeding ahead, but also sort of retrenched as far as the argument goes.
Well, fantastic stuff. Nick McDonald is the author. The book is called The Civilization of Perpetual Movement, Nomads in the Modern World. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And there we have it, Andrew. That was edition 350 of the Monocle Weekly. Nice round number, nice round show. I'm still looking with envy at your rather beautiful flower arrangement there.
Although Ming has left rather a lot of flowers and a nice kind of box for you to have a go afterwards.
Exactly.
So I'll be judging you. I think that was one of my favourite shows ever.
Yeah.
It's just the scale of her business is incredible. And Such a nice thing to do, make a flower arrangement.
It's pretty good,
on the radio.
It's pretty good. It smells pretty heady in here. For once, I'm quite in favour of turning on the air conditioning before I sort of pass out. Before I suddenly, I didn't realise I suffer from hay fever, but maybe I don't. So yeah, I'm going to go away. I'm going to busy myself. I'm going to get out the pruning shears.
Okay.
It's not really the right terminology, isn't it? And get involved. And
secateurs is the word.
And try and bish, bash, bosh and come up with something as the equal of Andrew Tuck's flower arrangement. Thanks also to Ben Ratliff and Nick McDonald and two other fantastic guests. And thank you also to our friends behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall and researched by Mari Giusti. And our studio manager was Claire Urban. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound,
me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.